I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Censored, the podcast where I try and try again to find the filth in banned books. I'm Aoife Vrithnoch, historian and thirsty reader. As I start Season 6, I want to thank you all for listening. If you want to support the show, check out the links in the show notes to merch and Patreon. But if you can't do that, share your love by reviewing the podcast. Or share the episode link with your mammy. I'll bet your mam has read lots of these dirty old books herself. I decided to begin this new season with a notorious novel by a woman now as infamous as her books. The Country Girls was Edna O'Brien's first novel, published in 1960 to great acclaim in the English-speaking world. An Irish national newspaper described it as quite remarkable. It's a tale of friendship, family and romance set half in rural Ireland, half in Dublin. Kathleen Brady is the heroine of this coming-of-age novel, though her best friend Baba Brennan is a pretty memorable character too. Lots of you will have heard of The Country Girls before, because it's one of the most notorious Irish novels of the 20th century. That's all the censors' fault, because they banned it in June 1960. Archbishop John Charles McQuaid, the panto villain of censorship scandals, said it was a smear on Irish womanhood. I'm both impressed and intrigued. So many stories swirl around The Country Girls, book burnings, threatening letters, protests, that you can lose sight of the novel itself. It's part one of a trilogy, so I've decided to read them all this season. I want to discover how the novels and the scandals relate to each other, beginning with this one, The Country Girls, then The Lonely Girl, which was published in 1962, through to the last work, Girls in Their Married Bliss, from 1964. Of course, Edna O'Brien wasn't the first Irish woman writer to be censored, but she was the first to vociferously and publicly condemn her blacklisting. She embraced the notoriety, so her activism is also part of the story. To open my deep dive into the Country Girls trilogy, I'm joined by Dr. Maureen O'Connor of University College Cork. Maureen has already written a lot about O'Brien, and her new book, Edna O'Brien and the Art of Fiction, will be published this October. Hi Maureen, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me. This is my first podcast, so I'm very excited.
Ooh, well, I hope it'll be a good experience. So I normally open with a drink that sort of reflects the book or is inspired by the book. And there was actually quite a lot of drinks consumed in the book. Not so much food, but there were various beverages served. And the one that I decided to go for is Kathleen, the heroine of the story, is served cordial by a publican called Jack Holland, who's deeply embroiled with her mother and her father, and it's all very complicated. That, I thought there was something about the way he served her the cordial, and she's a child in the pub and he's being a bit gross. And I thought that was a really redolent moment. So that for me was my choice. But did you have any suggestions?
That is a redolent moment, but I cannot stand the thought of that cordial and how like dusty and sticky it must be. And I think I would go for, I think in later in the book, this is redolent of a different stage in the novel, when the two country girls have gone to Dublin and they are fascinated by the idea of pink gin. Now, it doesn't seem to live up to its to its appeal in the mind, but I think I could do something more with the pink gin than I could with the cordial.
Pink gin's very on trend right now, so they were ahead of their time. Yes, because they're trying to like be grown-ups and fancy and sitting around drinking gin.
And yet I think it's quite sweet and typical that they are trying to be sophisticated. This is their whole, you know, kind of vision for themselves, you know, buying black brassieres. But what seems to kind of appeal about the gin is that it's pink. So it's sort of like there's still a little like a childishness about it that I find quite charming about the whole, you know, their time in Dublin is amazingly innocent, really, in some ways.
Yeah, it is very sweet that just the way that they arrive, these ingenues off the bus from the bog, and they're like trying to work out how to fit into the big city and have a great time, preferably. That's their plan. And so reading it like a censor, I do think the idea that girls should have fun in the city would probably offend them for a start. But that's quite far into the book. So I was thinking, you know, if I'm reading it from the beginning with those censorship specs on, I thought that the first moment that sort of jumped off the page was when Kathleen talks about her best friend Baba and herself. And Baba is actually short for Bridget. And they're very good friends in a frenemy kind of tension filled way. And she talks about how they once took all their clothes off and tickled each other, and that Kathleen has had to bribe Baba to buy her silence ever since. And I thought that was definitely, that would really upset them, because it implied all sorts of furtive sexuality that children aren't supposed to have. So that was my thought that would tick a box for them. But are there any moments that you find particularly, you know, offensive to a censorship mindset that might jump off the page for them?
I think that is a, you know, an important moment, because that's right there that you picked out there. It's right there in the first chapter. And I mean, on the second or third page, we have, a discussion of Hickey, the farmhand, relieving himself in a peach tin that he dumps out the window. Like the book is kind of dirty in every sense of dirty, both sexually dirty and like, you know, bodily filth and emissions of various kinds right from the beginning. So I think it, you know, it starts in this, you know, earthy, the adjective frank gets applied to it many times over the decades, and there's no let up. And I do think that's definitely a shocking moment about the two girls, you know, tickling each other in this sexual way. And if it wasn't clear, within a few lines, Hickey again comes into it, and he interrupts Kathleen thinking about this particular sort of issue she has with Baba, and she confesses to him that she wants to become a nun, and he says, oh, that's disgusting, two heads on a pillow. And then she feels kind of sick. So like right away, the whole kind of forbidden sexual elements are brought in. And within the first chapter, as you mentioned, Jack Holland is introduced, and he, as you said, he's the creepy kind of predator who is always kind of importuning Kathleen for kisses and has a totally inappropriate erotic interest in her, and, you know, reveals later in the novel that he's assuming she's going to marry him. I mean, so you have like quite disturbing sexual sort of texture to this little girl's life right from the go. Like, she's aware of male urination. Like, I don't even know if I don't know, how young are you when you're a little girl when you realize that men have a particular way of urinating that's different than yours? I don't know. But it's so kind of gritty and earthy right from the start. And I think it just doesn't let up. And the kind of the idea of this being sinful, it really doesn't sort of come into the discussion at all, or even like the consciousness of Kathleen, I think, until she gets to the convent. And then again, there's more sort of, you know, same-sex desire there. Cynthia, the older girl who takes an interest in Kathleen, and they kiss on the landing, and Kathleen develops a passionate crush on one of the nuns. And there's even in the convent, you know, and then they write that dirty mass card. There, as you said, there's a kind of an almost precocious understanding of sexuality and the function of sex and all the, you know, bits and pieces from very early in the novel. I think feel like it just builds and builds and builds. And I'd say since you're reading this, it probably had a long list that was like filling up pages and pages. Personally, I feel that it comes to a kind of crescendo with that scene in the boarding house is the word I'm trying to think of, boarding house there at the end, when Mr. Gentleman persuades Kathleen for them to take their clothes off and look at each other naked before they go away for the weekend. And I think what it would be is the fact that the man's penis, Mr. Gentleman's penis, is hilarious. And Kathleen is just dying laughing at the goofiness of what the mechanics are like there. So I think, you know, this idea of kind of the purity of the young girl, and especially the kind of the Irish female in general, being a bit naive about sexuality as part of a certain picture of Irish womanliness. I mean, it's betrayed from the first page, and it builds and builds and builds to this scene at the end, which I think really the kind of the humor associated with the sexual, the kind of enjoyment. I know there's a kind of a frisson between that early scene that you're talking about, or the reference that you're talking about between Baba and Kathleen. It's secretive. There's a kind of an element of sort of exploitation and blackmail, but it's obviously also there's pleasure, you know. So the idea of sex being pleasurable, something that you can laugh about, something that you can enjoy, that that is a part of everyday life. I think all of that contributes to something that is just absolutely beyond the bounds of acceptability in the climate of, you know, 1960 Ireland for sure. Yeah,
it's fascinating what you say about secrecy. Actually, I think that's one of the more interesting parts of the way O'Brien constructs it, that the secrecy and the furtiveness is so much bound up with all of the sexuality that is expressed within it. It's all, you know, clandestine and secret, and we can't talk about it. But yet there appears to be a lot of it. And it seems to capture that contradiction of what we're learning about that time in Irish history, is that everyone was having quite a lot of sex. And it was just no one wanted to ever even say the word, but they were definitely up to it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's that kind of the forbidden secretive part of it is what is titillating and exciting about it, too. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's part of what one of the complications of Kathleen's sort of enjoyment of her, you know, these tickling scenes with Baba, is that it is meant to be a secret.
Like so much of her. Yeah. Her romantic life, which is she is trying to conceal from other people at all times. So apart from those individual sex scenes, I mean, the one with Mr. Gentleman in the boarding house is hysterically funny. I think we should recommend that to everyone for laughs alone. I did think that there was more that maybe would have upset the establishment conventional view of Ireland. Some of the big themes within O'Brien's work are definitely about exploring the darker side. And one that really struck me, because it's so much about rural Ireland, is not just the dirtiness, actually, which, of course, it's such a good way of understanding it. There is so much about toilets. The countryside is pretty, pretty manky, actually. But within rural Ireland, her father, Kathleen's father, he's, of course, the patriarch, the man of the house, and he's actually drinking his inheritance daily. And just in one line, there was just one line in which O'Brien said that the land had actually been inherited by him from his father, of course, who had taken it from, you know, previous English occupiers. So there is this sense that, like, the inheritors of colonialism have not done a good job of taking on the mantle of responsible patriarchy. I mean, there's still mortgages and debt and alcoholism and violence. You know, it's still a very unfortunate society to live in rural Ireland. It didn't turn into an idyll just because they're all independent and they're all in charge. Do you think that sort of critique and others like it was part of the furious response to the novel?
Absolutely. I think apart from the sexual frankness. I think the sort of, now this isn't like an Angela Ashes sort of misery lit, because I think there's an awful lot of joy in the novel, really. But it's also kind of unsparing in describing a quite impoverished rural experience. And, you know, it's not just drink. It's also the horses, you know, Mr. Brady is passionately addicted to, or keeps buying horses and selling off fields to buy more horses. An absolutely irresponsible patriarch. And, you know, you get you talked about drinking and meals. The description of meals is just painful. The way the mother is, you know, kind of having the, you know, the Pope's nose and dry toast. And she's always, you know, trying to economize. She's economizing. And she has her little, again, kind of stealthy cigarette. We find out later she goes into the never used drawing room to sneak a ciggy every so often. But yeah, you don't meet anybody who seems to be, in the countryside, doing well at all. I mean, definitely the kind of the mantle being passed on to the native Irish is not seen as something that has been successful. And I think this is a theme that O'Brien has picked up in later novels as well. I mean, a very similar kind of picture is in The House of Splendid Isolation, where there's somebody who has similarly got, you know, was a big house, a Protestant big house, and it's just been run into the ground. And this goes back to something else I think that you also picked up on, that there isn't this kind of bucolic, pastoral kind of idyll. I mean, everybody's either working hard or they're not working, or it's not in any way kind of the, you know, revival peasant ideal of people, you know, dancing at the crossroads or anything like that. It's quite brutal. You know, it's a real hard scrabble life that these characters are leading, and that is not really helping kind of a picture of Ireland. One of the things I was thinking about since we were planning on talking about this novel, it just so happened there was a piece in the Irish Times yesterday about kind of, you know, modernizing Ireland in this period. And just before this novel appears, we have in the 50s, we have the establishment of Bord Fáilte. We have the first transatlantic flight by Aer Lingus to New York. We have you know, you have films that start selling a particularly kind of, you know, rural image of Ireland, like the Quiet Man across the diaspora. And so, you know, tourism as a hugely important industry is being established just before this novel appears. And there's a particular vision of Ireland as a place to visit, sentimental and nostalgic, and again, the countryside as this kind of retreat, which it has been sort of in the colonial imagination for centuries at this stage. But as an actual selling point, a way to make money, is just kind of coming into kind of consciousness and realization. And to show this kind of Ireland in a really widely read popular novel, I think is also one of the reasons why there was a bit, it wasn't just political or moral or religious, but it was there was like some economic anxiety, I think, around seeing something like this going abroad, literally.
I do often wonder about those early American tourists arriving into Ireland with its, you know, rudimentary facilities, shall we say.
Yeah, basic. My father was in the travel industry. Basic is what that's called. Yeah.
I know, kind of electricity sometimes, toilets hardly ever. Yeah, and I do think that's something that when you read it, that's part of the texture of the novel. Although, as you say, it's not misery lit at all. So it's now infamous, of course, because it was banned. I mean, if you type banned books Ireland into Google, The Country Girls will be one of the few that comes up. Now, there are lots there, as we know now, there are hundreds and thousands of books that are actually banned. So it's more about the reaction that the banning provoked, isn't it? That's why it became famous. It's one of the notable censorship scandals of the 20th century. And why do you think that the blacklisting of The Country Girls made news then and still continues to be discussed, really?
I think the kind of the whiplash is one reason, because when it had been very heavily, and I think, you know, very professionally, skillfully promoted before it even appeared. And so it was eagerly anticipated. It was received rapturously in the English-speaking world. I mean, the initial reviews in the UK, in Ireland, in the United States were just almost over the top, you know. So there was this absolute excessive language about what was in store, you know, this wonderful new writer. And it doesn't hurt at all that she was, you know, physically very attractive, you know, so, you know, that always sells, you know, and you have a kind of a beautiful young woman who has, you know, kind of shaved a couple of years off, so she seemed even younger than she was, and didn't mention the fact that she was the mother of two small children, just like she was just kind of fresh off the farm herself kind of promotion, which I have no problem with. Look, you know, she's like a TikTok influencer, you know, kind of thing. She's got her persona, which doesn't necessarily have to map onto her private self. So there was this just huge embrace of the novel and of herself when she first appeared. And then just, this is the worst thing that ever happened. And I mean, she's, you know, a blot on Ireland. It was such a sudden seeming turnaround. And of course, you know, the Irish Censorship Board and John Charles McQuaid, this was notorious among writers whose own works had not been allowed to enter into Ireland. I mean, it was a cause célèbre among writers that she had been, you know, after such a rapturous kind of initial reception, that she had been banned. So the fact that somebody who, you know, seemed to be poised for massive, you know, international success would be banned, I think it also appealed to a kind of prurience maybe outside of Ireland. You know, a kind of a fascination with the backwardness of Ireland. Like it's a similar kind of weird fascination that we have with what we think of as kind of, you know, benighted, backward, like savage primitives, you know. So to go back to kind of her telegenic sort of qualities, you know, she was being interviewed like on, you know, programs in Panorama and places, and she was really milking, again, I think, intelligently, the fact of being banned and of being censored, and helping it to promote sales. And absolutely it did, you know, and it made her and the book notorious. And it is, you know, I don't think that it's her best book. I think there are other novels that are as good, but it's the one that is remembered. And I think because of the incredible kind of flap around it and all these stories, again, that I don't know what the source, for instance, the story that it was banned in the chapel yard in her home village. I can't find any actual evidence that ever happened, but what a great story that the priest burned copies of the book in the, you know, so the promotion machine kind of really worked with that. So I think that explains maybe why it was such a kind of sensation at the time. Why does it continue to be something that we think about? I suppose certainly those State of the Nation novels of the late 90s, not so much Wild Decembers, but definitely House of Splendid Isolation, Down by the River, In the Forest. Those were all novels that kind of reignited the outrage machine in the Irish, you know, official Ireland, especially Irish media. And to some extent, English media, but especially in Ireland, that, you know, who does she think she is talking about, you know, the X case or the IRA or the Troubles or a notorious murder in Clare, you know, kind of she was very much a truth teller again. And everybody got angry all over again with her. So it just kind of brought up all those old memories, I think, in some ways.
Interesting. Yeah, I've read some of those. I read some of those in the 90s. Now, I didn't like them at the time, so I am going to try and revisit them, actually. But I don't know, now that you say that it was because of the negative public perception around them at the time. You know, I don't remember the publicity around the book. But of course, that really does infect how you read texts, because it's just the background kind of noise. So, God, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and a lot of this also comes down to gender, because, you know, certainly men seem to be able to write about real life murders, you know, lightly fictionalized notorious crimes or whatever, without getting the kind of attacks that Edna O'Brien got from people that we, you know, all seem to admire greatly, like Fintan O'Toole, when she wrote about the Imelda Riney murders in the forest. I mean, she was just savaged for doing that. Like an unwomanly lack of sensitivity to the families, you know. I don't, you know, why she was expected to have like extra sensitivity. And yeah, you know, again, kind of airing Ireland's dirty laundry, like Down by the River and family rape and abortion and the X case. And I understand it because she had gotten so much bad publicity for so many decades that, you know, I'm kind of a latecomer to my appreciation for her because I swallowed all of that stuff down as much as anybody did. So you just have this almost knee-jerk reaction. Well, if she said it, there's something wrong. There's something inaccurate. There's something she's dramatizing. But she is rarely dramatizing the truth, really.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
And she is often, I suppose, herself personally, conflated with her fiction in ways, I think, like you say about the men. I mean, John McGaughran's work is heavily autobiographical, especially the earliest novels, and no one really holds that against him or the books. They just sort of shrug it off. So why do you think it happened to her? Is this one of those gender problems again in the reception of literature?
Yes, I mean, I think she's not alone in this, and this has been written about, that it does seem to be more grating for some reason for readers and reviewers when a woman has autobiographical elements in her writing. Certainly, as you say, John McGaughran didn't have any kind of negative feedback because of that, or someone else who she gets compared to, Philip Roth, like Portnoy's Complaint, again, very much based on his own experience. And I mean, that book caused outrage, but not because it was autobiographical. But I think in O'Brien's case in particular, this has been maybe abetted by the efforts of her husband at the time to kind of cast himself as the actual author. He just took her sort of her gushing kind of memories that she wrote down and crafted them into fiction. And then his nephew, Stan Gebler Davies, you know, continued that, you know, kind of campaign of discrediting her. And in the, when Time and Tide, that novel came out, he wrote a supposed review of it where he talks about, oh, well, women, or not women, but housewives from Wimbledon, you know, sort of run their knickers to the typewriter.
Oh, it's outrageous.
Yeah.
When I read about her husband trying to sort of say, well, actually, you know, I had to tidy it up because it was a bit crap, I couldn't believe it. I was like, God almighty, she literally was being robbed of her authorial rights. Oh.
There was, as I said, there was, you know, like himself and his nephew kind of kept up this narrative that she just sort of effortlessly wrote down the things that happened to her. Like there was no artistry involved. And I think this is also where we get into a larger sort of gendered issue. And this has to do also with the kinds of things that are, that, you know, happen to women in their personal lives. When that appears in fiction, That's, oh, well, that's, that sounds like her personal problems. There's nothing sort of universal or abstract about a woman's life, whereas a man writing about his life, oh, like, this is the human struggle, and oh, we can learn so much about our human nature from this individual man's autobiography, but a woman's autobiography has nothing to say to us. That's just, there's this, I think that that's a larger issue that gets, that she gets caught up in with her book. So, I mean, and the idea that she lacks an artistry or ability, again, you know, a seed planted by her husband, persisted for decades in, you know, reviews and critiques of her work, that she was, you know, ungrammatical and, you know, unconscious. She was somehow unconsciously writing. And it wasn't just, you know, male reviewers either. I mean, that's, I think it was Victoria Glendinning who talked about how she doesn't seem to even understand what she's doing. I mean, every writer, there's some element of it that is outside of your conscious kind of deliberation, but you still are always making choices and know what you're doing to a great extent.
The Country Girls was written very quickly, though, wasn't it? I think maybe that helped feed into the narrative that it was... it was just kind of simple in a kind of an uncontrived literary sense, because she did write it quite quickly.
Yeah, she did. And I think a lot of first novels get written very quickly. I don't think that's at all unusual. And I think it's also important to keep in mind, which doesn't enter into the story very much, is that she had been writing for quite a while at that stage. She had, you know, she had published little sketches and short stories and even pieces about what it meant to be a writer. You know, she had been writing. So it's not like I've never sat at a typewriter before. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a novel. You know, it didn't happen like that. Maybe part of that is a little mythologized, again, deliberately mythologized, cannily mythologized, that it is this, you know, just sort of, you know, rush of inspired writing. But I still do believe that it probably the actual writing probably was something that had been building and building and building. Again, it's not at all unusual for a first novel to be very quickly written, because you've been sort of storing it up, especially if you're somebody who is determined to write a novel. And I think she had that ambition for a while. It isn't just that it just kind of happened somehow. You know, she was working in publishing at the time. And as I say, she had been, you know, Saturday Evening Post and The Bell and lots of places had, she'd placed her writing in a number of prestigious journals up until this period. Yeah.
It's fascinating how there's that tension in our understanding of the book between all of the publicity around it and the person herself, and then the text, and how all of these things kind of work together, and then the legacies. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about a book that becomes famous like this, is how it achieves all of these layers, and, you know, our relationship is very complicated because of that.
Yeah, and she's, you know, she's somebody who has been interviewed so much. There's just no way, when I was trying to kind of encompass the massive amount of material there is on her, I mean, interviews alone, it's just amazing. And there were certain stories that she would tell and retell, and they'd be slightly different, you know, every time. But it has this momentous kind of place in Irish cultural memory, for sure.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that I was waiting a long time to read it in order to try and understand more about the books around it before I tackled it. And I have to say, I'm both glad that I didn't read it till now, but also sorry, because I feel like I should have read this actually probably when I was about 13, would have been the perfect moment to read it. But it was, of course, it was... you know, for me at 13, it would be considered an old book and I wouldn't have been interested. So we will move on to the best part. The best part of the podcast really is Censorship Bingo.
Oh, okay, great.
People tell me this is their favourite part. And who am I? Who am I to say no? I'm intrigued to see, because it's such an infamous book and its legacy is so much about its filthiness in a explicit sexual sense, just how many scores it gets on the bingo card. Right, so starting as usual with breasts.
There's definitely a lot about breasts in it.
There's a lot about bras as well, which is almost as bad, I feel, for the times.
Yeah, and that goes back to the funny, like, filthiness, I mean, like in the, you know, the physical sense of how they want to buy black brassieres so they don't have to wash them as much.
Yes, rudimentary bathing facilities are a big issue.
And I mean, and that's kind of one of the really funny parts of the novel when the girls are eating this horrendous meat in the convent, and Baba stuffs hers down her jersey front, and then she's pretending that it's breasts, and she's walking around with this rotten meat in her top. And they're putting a udder infusion that's meant for cows onto their own like budding breast. I mean, there's a lot of breast obsession actually in the novel.
Yes, although normally when I do the breast section in the censorship bingo, it's male authors, so it's a totally different way of thinking about boobs in this particular one. But yeah, we would have to tick that with bells on. Next up, bestiality. Well, no. Definitely not. Sex work. I didn't think that even there was a mention, not even a hint, because Kathleen is quite innocent. Although Baba does like going out for dinner in the hopes of getting, you know, like she uses her sexuality to get free drink and dinner. But it's not quite sex work.
Yeah, I don't think it quite gets to that level. No.
Racism. No, I didn't think so.
No.
Although there are quite a lot of non-Irish people in the book, and they play a very interesting role in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, Mr. Gentleman and the landlady, Joanna. Yeah.
Joanna,
and
yeah.
And the other people in the boarding house, yeah.
And drugs. I didn't think so. Obviously booze, yes.
Yeah, a lot of alcohol.
A lot of alcohol. Now, she is given some sort of pills when she learns of her mother's death.
That's
right. She's sort of drugged up. So I suppose we could take it for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's. Politics. I mean, not explicitly, but in all sorts of other ways.
Implicitly, yeah. So maybe not really if we're...
Yeah. It's not obvious, as in it's obvious to, you know, Irish critics at the time, but perhaps not anyone else.
Yeah.
Swearing. No, everyone's very well spoken, aren't they?
Yeah. I don't remember any swears, as the kids say.
Yes, and I think that reflects that tone, like that it's from a young girl's perspective. The language is very clean. Infidelity. Well, yes. Absolutely.
Yes. Mr. Gentleman is married, and you have the kind of suggestion of some kind of flirtation or whatever between, as you say, Jack Holland and Kathleen's mother. And, you know, where does Kathleen's mother go? Like, that's always that, you know, she vanishes with the man. Like, what? I mean, it's not ever actually confirmed that she's dead. It's
yes.
Just assumed. And Martha Brennan hanging out in the lobby or in the bar, or whatever, you know, she's kind of loose, you know, whatever. There's something going on there too. So definitely infidelity, at least implied, or the possibility of it is on the horizon for sure.
I do think Martha Brennan going to the local hotel, was it with a blazer and a bra and no shirt on? I was like, what? I mean, in the 1950s? So yes, definitely infidelity. Crime. All of the sleazy men around these very young girls. Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, Kathleen is what, 14? 12, 14? And Jack Holland is, you know, we're going to get married and... Although it's not written in a really sinister, sleazy way, it is unpleasant and definitely criminal, even by those standards.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we could tick that. Genitalia.
Yes.
Yes. That's in the incident in the convent when the girls write that smutty line.
Yeah.
About Father, what's his name, having a long thing.
Yeah, also, I mean, the scene with Mr. Gentleman in the sitting room of the boarding house. And it's implied in the tickling that we started out talking about. So, yeah.
So, yes, we can tick that. Abortion. Not in this one. No. Orgies. Well, no.
Good heavens, no. They wouldn't even know what that meant if you asked any of the characters. I don't think.
No. Yes, they're quite innocent. Sexual assault.
I suppose it depends on what you mean by sexual assault. I mean, I certainly feel that, you know, Jack Holland is attempting sexual assault.
The inappropriate advances. And I mean, Mr. Gentleman also, although, you know, Kathleen wants him to kiss her, she is a child.
Yeah, like she cannot give consent.
No, absolutely not. So yeah, we could take that, I think. Extramarital pregnancy. I don't think so. No. Masturbation. No.
Mutual masturbation, maybe. But
possibly. Are they tickling themselves or each other?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the question. Yeah, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think it's enough. Sex toys, definitely not. Feminism. See, this is always an interesting one as to, you know, how you discuss these things. This women-centered narrative and the fact that the girls and the women behave in their own way, I think, in a way that seems to be without reference to men, or at least in ways that men dislike intensely. I think that that's quite a feminist
attitude. I think
attitude.
So, too. And I think even just being so frank about the exploitation and the, you know, both kind of the ways in which, you know, Kathleen's mother is just a kind of a slave to the house, and Mrs. Brennan, you know, ends up kind of, you know, disappointed and miserable. I think definitely showing the misery of kind of the patriarchal marriage and all those things. I feel that there's no question, but it's a feminist text. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should take that. Next up is divorce. No, because, I mean, it's completely illegal and impossible to have.
Yeah.
And on other things that were illegal and impossible to have, contraception.
That's right, yeah.
There is, like, Joanna, when Kathleen is preparing to go to Vienna, which sounds amazing, with Mr. Gentleman, Joanna says, yeah, you don't want to end up with a baby at the end of it.
Yeah.
So there is, in that sentence, a hint that there are ways not to. But poor Kathleen, of course, doesn't even know what she's talking about, which is really tragic that she's going to make this amazing step.
Well, she's so innocent because she... because she says, you know, oh, we don't have to worry about that because we won't be married. In her head, she's saying, well, yeah, but you don't get babies till you've been married for a while. So I don't think that's...
Yeah.
I don't know why she's even bringing that up. It's just...
I know, it's tragic. So I think that one sentence merits a tick because they are so super sensitive to any concept of contraception. And next up, menstruation. No.
No,
surely
I mean,
not.
It is something that's in a lot of the novels and stories, but it's not here, no.
Then there's blasphemy.
I suppose it depends on how you define it. Certainly the dirty verse on the mass card was considered blasphemous.
Oh, that's true. They
but
actually
that's kind
said
of an
that.
Attempt at blasphemy. I don't know if they achieved blasphemy, but they try to be blasphemous.
They did write about sex on the reverse of a mass card, which was... I mean, it's pretty offensive to Catholic beliefs. Blasphemy. Well, do you know what? I think we should take it because it, you know, the book really did provoke an overreaction from clerics as well. So, yes. And then oral sex. No. No sex really happens at all, actually, in spite of what you might think. Graphic violence. I mean, she is beaten by her father once or twice at the beginning.
Yeah. But it's not graphic, though.
No, it's more the threat and the impending fear that he's going to walk across the threshold. So, no, I don't think we can tick that. LGBTQI content. I mean, I don't think so. Or did I miss
really?
Something?
I mean, I guess I feel that there's a lot of same-sex desire between Baba and Kathleen, between Kathleen and Cynthia, between Kathleen and the nun. You know, I feel like there is those objects of desire seem so much more desirable the way they're represented in the novel than any of the men. I mean, even Mr. Gentleman, when she describes him, you're like, ew.
Oh,
I
know.
Gross. Like, there's nothing. He's like gray and old and colorless lips. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, like she's kissing him and it's all romantic. She opens her eyes and goes, he looks very, very old.
Yeah. It's almost like she's trying to manufacture this, you know, love object out of, you know, the very poor materials that are at hand. Whereas like other women and other girls and nuns and, you know, they're actually attractive and they're, you know, they're desirable in a way that doesn't seem as manufactured as the whole thing with Mr. Gentleman. Yeah.
Yes, and it's much more joyful and easy and relaxed with in those contexts than, yeah, Mr. Gentleman, which is all stress and worry. So yeah, we should tick that. So let me see. How many do we have? 9.
Yeah.
9. That's not bad. I mean, the ones that score the highest tend to be about the 15, 16. So
yeah,
it's a long way to go before it gets to Catch 22 or Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, even in our discussion of them, we had to sort of interpret, you know, could this be considered blasphemy? Yeah, it's not really scoring that high.
No, I think if you read it as a casual reader without working very hard, I think that you would probably give it about a 5, really.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. So in spite of its reputation, it's a very mild book in that sense, in an explicit sexual sense. And especially when you consider, as you go into the 60s, how explicit the books are going to get.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's I think as you pointed out, it's much more offensive of sensibilities and, you know, kind of a protective idea of Irishness and the purity of Irish womanhood and the whole, you know, Madonna image of the, you know, the virginal Irish mother. Those are the kinds of pieties that are being blasphemed, if you will, by the book. There's really nothing salacious in the novel. There really isn't.
Yeah. I'm sorry for people who are looking for salacious reading. Of course, I suppose taking the figure of girls who are often the focus of the fear around censorship, like the girl figure, this innocent young person who's going to pick up the wrong book and be corrupted.
Yeah.
And here in The Country Girls are two girls who don't, in a way, need any books to be corrupted. They are already, you know, offending against all of those sensibilities and are uncontrollable and different, in spite of the fact that they are really very nice girls, you know.
Yeah,
they're not,
I mean,
difficult,
I think,
girls.
That's what's really interesting about the way that these girls are represented, because they are quite knowing in some ways, and they are, and I suppose that has to do with growing up in the country. There's certain things that you just know about sex when you grow up in the country. You can't be avoided. And yet they remain so naive and innocent and sweet somehow at the same time. They're not jaded. They're not nasty. They're not, they don't seem to have been sort of damaged in any way. I think that as the trilogy proceeds, you can see the way some of these things that have been established actually do end up damaging them. But if you're just reading this novel, it's as we said earlier on, it's life affirming, really, and joyous more than it's anything else.
Yeah, it's a really lovely book to read. And I think, you know, certainly if you want to while away a Sunday and have a pleasant read, it's one of those, it's a pleasant read, which you couldn't say for McGahern's The Dark, which is from the same period. I mean, that is a hard book to read.
That's a brutal book to read. Yeah.
It wouldn't cheer you up on a rainy Sunday afternoon, but The Country Girls actually would. So
yeah.
I think we should all go out and read it more.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It is not a dark novel, which I think maybe is part of what made some critics start to turn against O'Brien as the trilogy develops, because they do get darker, especially the last volume and the epilogue that, you know, came along later. The vision really does darken quite a bit, I think appropriately and reasonably, you know, logically. But people really responded to, I think, initially the freshness and the sweetness of this novel and wanted more of that, please, rather than kind of, you know, the reality of maturing and learning the truth of the world, you know.
Yes, because it is, of course, part one in a trilogy. And so it's a coming of age trilogy, you could say. And this is the girly bit.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Maureen, for talking to me. That was wonderful. I had a great time.
That was very fun. I, and, you know, it was interesting because I actually was realizing some new things about the book as we were talking, which is great, you know, and that I think that's a testament to the book. I thought I had thought this book to death at this stage, but there's still something new, you know, and that's why a book is a classic, because there's always something new to find in it. Yeah,
there is. I mean, my 13-year-old self didn't appreciate that old books can have new things to say to younger readers, but I have learned since then.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much, Aoife.
So that's book one done. The rest of the trilogy will be along later in the season. Episode 5 will be on The Lonely Girl and episode 10 on Girls in Their Married Bliss. There's plenty of time to read them if you want to avoid any spoilers. And Edna O'Brien is still writing. She has outlasted all her male contemporaries, which may be another reason people are pissed off with her. She has definitely won the long game, as the rest of the deep dive into the trilogy will reveal. But next episode, we'll leave the woes of rural Ireland behind and examine a proper porno called The Memoirs of Dolly Morton. It's antique porn from 1898, set in the slave-owning state of Virginia. And it probably inspired a moment in James Joyce's Ulysses. I wasn't particularly surprised to see it on the blacklist. I mean, it is actual porn, except that it was banned in 1994. I know, it's mental. And the book is truly a wild ride, so there's lots to talk about. Till then, keep your hands clean and your minds filthy.